proceed to the second case of the day, Holland versus the City of Chicago. Ms. Fryer.
May it please the court. Dana Holland, the appellant in this case, spent 10 years in prison for a rape he did not commit. After being incarcerated for a 10-year period, his conviction was overturned when he was exonerated through DNA evidence.
Could I ask a preliminary question? They said something about he was serving 28 years.
Correct.
When did that start, and was it ongoing during this?
It was ongoing. He was incarcerated from the time, actually, that he was charged with the crime, I believe. I don't think he ever received any bond. I'm not exactly sure about that. But
what was the crime?
Aggravated rape.
The one for 28 years?
Yes. Okay. That's correct.
And,
yes.
And so that was, he was in prison all this time?
He was in prison for 10 full years until the DNA evidence came through. Yes, without any break. That's correct. Oftentimes in this country, unfortunately, our criminal justice system is not perfect. There are many cases in which someone is exonerated ultimately by DNA evidence. What makes this situation unusual is that his conviction was procured pretty much solely because of the misconduct of the police officers who arrested him. They procured false statements, particularly a false identification from the victim at the scene of the crime. And they gave her false information, pretty much forcing her to make a false identification before she was permitted to go home. As a preliminary matter, I think it's significant that the defendant admits that the district court did not view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. That is not in dispute. The court did not do that. The court impermissibly engaged in credibility determinations and speculation and conjecture that is absolutely impermissible on a motion for summary judgment. And I think the defendant agrees with that. So our statements of facts aren't very different at all when it comes to the salient facts in this case. The defendant has included some facts we believe to be irrelevant, concerning the alibi evidence, concerning another crime he was charged with. That has absolutely nothing to do with this malicious prosecution case or the due process claim. I think that possibly prejudiced Judge Zagel and led to his opinion.
What did?
The fact that he was charged with another crime, and that was brought up during the summary judgment, the fact that that particular crime was committed by him, allegedly by him and his uncle, none of that should have had anything to do with his wrongful conviction for the rape. It should not have been considered.
The other one was committed by him and his uncle?
The uncle who was the perpetrator, ultimately in this case, the DNA was a match to his uncle who lived in the same house with him.
And he testified, didn't he?
He testified at the trial and said that he had had sexual contact with the victim, but did not admit to the rape, per se.
He said it was consensual, but it was at the same time.
It was at the same time, yes. He said he basically was admitting that he was the person who had sexual contact with the victim. But the other concession that the defendants make that is significant is they come right out and state that if the statements were made by the officers in question, the coercive statements, the way to show up took place three times, her saying that it wasn't him. On the third time, she became agitated and said, I'm telling you, it's not him. The fact that Officer Piekarski told her several times she could not go home. This woman was brutally raped for 5 to 6 hours, was 8 months pregnant at the time, and was being told she could not go home until she identified Mr. Holland.
Stanley? This is Stanley, right?
It's that female officer, Piekarski.
No, what?
The victim, Dion Stanley.
She was eight months pregnant?
Yes, she was. And
she was with the rapist for quite a bit of time.
In fact, she met him at a bar, and I think that's significant because we're not dealing with a case where somebody got a brief glimpse of their rapist or, you know, could be mistaken about the identity. She spent several hours with him before she was basically kidnapped and raped for several hours, and she knew what he looked like.
Well, where was Holland during all this?
He
other than, I mean, several hours before when obviously she's with the perpetrator.
Right, and as I explained in my opening statement of facts, this was not developed fully on the summary judgment level, but there was documentation to support it in the record. And what my client explained was that he lived in the basement of this apartment complex that had an upstairs and a downstairs and a basement apartment. He had to go outside to get to the basement. So he'd been upstairs with his grandmother having a few beers and watching television, and he fell asleep. And he took showers upstairs. There was no shower in the basement.
This is all day or something.
Right, he'd been up there at least for the better part of the evening since he got home from work.
Well, obviously, the reason I'm looking at it is when she was, say, consensually in the bar getting drunk and running out of whatever they wanted to get, and then never went out to get something.
Right.
I'm talking about that period of time.
Right.
All he had to do was have an alibi where he was then.
Well, he had been at work, and then he was at home. I mean, his alibi was that he was at home. It was the middle of the night. The police officers.
But she was all afternoon with this guy.
Right, right. That's correct. I don't know if he was questioned about where he was earlier in the day. I know he said that, you know, that at least for the bulk of the time that the rape was occurring, he was at home. He had been at work. He had his work clothes with him. That's what he was carrying down to his apartment at the time he was spotted by Officer Cullinan. So he had been upstairs. He fell asleep.
Were those the pants? These cartoon pants?
Well, those were his work pants, and there were cartoons on the waistband. I know that's probably the only piece of possible physical evidence that exists against him.
Well, that's pretty significant evidence.
Well, you know, what she described was cartoons on the pants. She never said the waistband, first of all. You know, second of all, there's an issue as to when that information was conveyed to the officers. Part of the problem here is that the first and third elements of malicious prosecution are being confused by both the district court or combined in some manner and the defendant. And it creates confusion as to what timing is important in terms of what time do we look at the state of the mind of the police officers and what information they had. And so the record is unclear as to when exactly they were given this information about cartoon pants, and it wasn't cartoons on the waistband particularly. That's not what she said. So if they actually came to the scene, saw a black man running away, and then before they got any further description, when Officer Cullinan was looking for the knife, he stopped and pulled his weapon on Mr. Holland, who was very cooperative, by the way, so we have to take that into consideration, his demeanor and the demeanor of the victim, who was never afraid of him and never displayed any fear of him. But
he was supposedly at a trash can or something.
Well,
with the pants that had the cartoon waistband or whatever, and
he had empty beer bottles with him, and he had his pants folded up, and he was carrying his pants with his ID, his work pants, down to the basement with him because he had showered upstairs earlier in the day. That's where his shower was.
I'm talking about what the police didn't see that. The police are. They're looking for somebody. They have a report that he has these pants that have this some cartoon thing.
Right.
That's what they're told.
Correct, Judge.
And now they see him in the vicinity with what looks like disposing of pants that have this cartoon thing on the belt or whatever. Is that true or not?
No, that's disputed in terms of the disposing of. He did have the pants in his possession, but they were folded up, and he was intending to throw away the beer bottles. But
he's outside with the pants in his hand.
That's right, with his ID in the
trash
pocket. With his ID in the pocket, though. It doesn't make sense that he would throw away the pants that were used in the rape with his identification and his wallet in the pocket. That would lead the police straight back to him. It doesn't make any sense. But I think for purposes of summary judgment, we have to assume that Mr. Holland's testimony is correct, that he was standing over the garbage can getting ready to drop the beer bottles in there when Officer Cullinan came upon him, pulled his weapon, and said, "Drop everything." So he dropped everything, including his folded pants with his identification in them. If he was trying to dispose of evidence, he certainly wouldn't leave his identification in the evidence he was disposing. That just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
What was he wearing?
You know, I don't know that that's clear in the record, what he was wearing, actually. I know as far as the shoes go, he was wearing...
This is February, so it's cold, I assume.
Right. I don't know that he was wearing a sort of jacket or it's just not in the record what he was wearing exactly, other than the shoes. And the shoes he was wearing did not match the footprints that were in the snow, and his shoes were actually a size smaller, as his feet were a size smaller.
Well, half size.
I'm sorry.
Half size. But then there's these other shoes are found inside the house, and they were the shoes, apparently, that made the footprint.
Actually, what's in the record is that they were wet. There's no testimony in the record that they were the shoes that made the footprint. So that's a stretch. That is a stretch, and nobody testified that they were the shoes that made the footprint.
See, the problem here, as I see it, part of it is that, you know, we have to view the facts in the light most favorable to your client, and I think you're correct in saying that the defendants have acknowledge that some of these facts were not viewed that way by the district court. However, what we're looking at and what I would think that the focus is on, what did the police think at the time?
Right, that's correct.
And what do they think when they see him in February outside with pants in his hand? He may have, as you say, may have been there to throw some beer bottles away and just happened to have the pants in his hand. But it could certainly look to them as if he's trying to throw the pants away. All right, he's got a wallet in there. Maybe he's going to take that out before he throws it away. I don't know. But that's the focus of this case, isn't it? It's on what did they think. And I'm just trying to... I understand that there's a half inch, a half size different in shoes, but that's fairly insignificant, I think. The shoes are inside the house that are wet, and the police think that those are the footprints in the snow that led to the back of the house.
I agree with you, Your Honor, but you can't look at what you just described in a vacuum, okay? You have to look at, to describe the state of mind of the police officers, you have to look at the totality of circumstances to determine whether they had a reasonable suspicion. The evidence that you just described is the only evidence that supports in any conceivable manner any sort of reasonable suspicion. But what you have in addition to that is the fact that they never looked into who the car that the victim was raped in was registered to. In fact, Mr. Holland said, "That's my uncle's car. His name is Gordon Bolden. He lives in the apartment upstairs. That's the guy you want." And the victim even described that the rapist was curly-haired. My client was not. Mr. Bolden was.
Did she first see Bolden?
When did she first see him?
Yeah.
At the bar. She met him.
Oh, yeah, no.
Earlier
I mean,
that night.
I know at the scene then she says, "That's not him," and I understand everything that happened. And eventually she says, "Yeah, that is the guy." And the police attribute that to, well, she was scared or nervous or emotional when she said it wasn't him, and later she cleared up and said that was him. I understand all that. But when did she first lay eyes on the man who testified at the trial, "I was the one in the bar that had sex with her, and it was consensual"?
From the record, she contends that she was raped by him. I understand his testimony was different.
Oh, yes, I know, but when...
But she, my understanding from the record is that she saw his picture when the state's attorney Freeman, was trying to prep her for trial, and the picture was in the police file for some reason that's undisclosed in the record, and she said, "That's the guy, that's him," and reiterated that Dana Holland was not the perpetrator. So that's the first time, at least in the record, that she saw a picture of Mr. Bolden. That's the problem here. She identified him as the rapist. She described somebody who fit his description. Mr. Holland said, "That's the guy you want. That's his car. He's right upstairs." They never made any effort to even show her a picture of him.
What happened? Did she see him testify at the trial?
I don't know if she was in the courtroom at the time. Probably not. They probably had the witnesses separated. So.
I mean, it just seems so bizarre.
It is very bizarre. The circumstances of this case are very, very bizarre. And the totality of circumstances includes that Officer Piekarski sat in the car with her and very heavy-handedly said, you have to identify this guy. She wasn't afraid of him. So, you know, any notion that the police were being reasonable because the victim was scared, I mean, she said she was never afraid of Dana Holland because he wasn't the rapist, and she knew he wasn't the rapist. So you also have to look at the way they conducted the show-up. You know, we had an expert testify that that's the least preferred way of doing an identification. And if you look at the 7 criteria for conducting a show-up, if you are going to do one, the police violated every single criteria for conducting a show-up. They brought the perpetrator to the victim in the car, handcuffed. They did it multiple times. There's no need for them to conduct themselves in that manner. And really, there's no evidence whatsoever to lead them to have a reasonable suspicion other than his proximity to the crime. And, you know, he lived in the building, so that was the explanation for that. And I think it's one of the critical issues. Well, I guess I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there's a question.
You've used all your time, but I'm going to give you some rebuttal time.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to hear what your next comment was before I give you the extra time.
Sure. The probable cause issue is particularly, I think, important in this case. The defense and the district court misinterpret the law and the burden of proof. We do not have to show that there was no probable cause for the prosecution, only that there was no probable cause for the arrest. So it's very critical that the court interpret the law correctly, and I believe that both the defendant and the district court are mistaken in that regard.
So, Dan, did you want to make any comment about the Brady issue in this case?
Well, I think my reply brief pretty much says it all. The defendant's position on the Brady issue is twofold. One, that the evidence was not suppressed, which is difficult to believe since, they never admitted the statements, the coercive and false statements that were made to the victim. They also say that the defendant didn't, or the criminal defendant didn't use reasonable diligence in uncovering evidence. But I think we can assume that the officers would not have been forthcoming with any inquiry as to whether they were suppressing evidence. And we did actually have a representative talk to the victim, but she was so afraid of law enforcement, she lied. So I don't think that breaks the chain of causation. It's particularly disturbing when they argue that the evidence was not material because it wouldn't have changed the result. And I guess the argument there appears to me to be that the subsequent misconduct of the state's attorney in threatening her with a perjury charge if she didn't testify and keeping her in jail 31 days before the trial somehow breaks the chain of causation. I think that argument really has no basis in law and needs to be rejected. So
I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate it.
Ms. Enriquez?
May it please the court. Responding to an emergency dispatch, officers Cullinan and Piekarski arrived at the scene of a rape. Both the victim and the rapist jumped out of the car. The victim went to the officers, and the rapist ran away. These and other officers tracked footprints in the snow from the car to the building where Mr. Holland lived, and they found wet gym shoes in the building, and the impressions from the treads of those shoes matched the footprints in the snow. But they found only one man in or near the building, Mr. Holland. He was holding blue jeans with cartoon characters on them, unusual jeans that matched precisely the ones that the victim said the rapist was wearing, and his identification was in one of the pockets. At Mr. Holland's criminal trial, the victim, Miss Stanley, identified Mr. Holland as the rapist. After DNA evidence exonerated Mr. Holland, he brought this case against the arresting officers and the city, alleging malicious prosecution and suppression of exculpatory evidence. Both claims fail. We do agree that the district court did not take the facts most favorably to the officers and the city, but the judgment was still correct.
Well, what if it's true that the victim confronted with Holland, So that's not the guy. He's not the guy. And then the police say, he is the guy. This is all the evidence we have. And they lean on her. You're not going home until you identify, or you know, whatever they say, until you identify him. And then they, then she turns over and says, okay, it is the guy. That's, if viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff here, is that a reasonable interpretation of what occurred?
Let me unpack that a little bit. The show up starts, and she initially says, it's not him. Well, the evidence was overwhelming. By the way, there was plenty of time for him to change those pants and change the shoes between the time that that the man ran away from the car, that the police officer saw the man run, the rapist run away from the car, and the time that they ultimately found Mr. Holland at the garbage cans in the alley. So he could have changed. He could have changed the pants and the shoes.
How much time passed?
Well, we don't know the exact amount of time that passed, but we do. It's undisputed that that the two men were together in the kitchen of the house. Holland and Bolden were together in the kitchen of the house before Mr. Holland left the house to go to the garbage can, and where Officer Cullinan encountered him. He would have had time to change shoes and change pants, and Officer Cullinan would have known that, because Officer Cullinan was the man who showed up at the rape scene when the rapist ran away from the car, so he knew how much time had passed. There's no doubt about the fact that the mere fact that the shoes that Holland was now wearing at the garbage can were not the same shoes that the same gym shoes that made the footprints in the snow. But going back to the show up, as Your Honor had pointed out, you have overwhelming evidence to these officers that this is the man. I mean, among other things, you've got, you know, the as Your Honor pointed out, these very unusual blue jeans that she says are blue jeans that with cartoon characters on them. And there's no dispute in this case that Mr. Holland was holding the same kinds of jeans that she said. So the officers would have thought at that point overwhelming evidence. And so they wouldn't have believed her. It would have been reasonable for officers, prudent officers in that situation, to understand that other reasons are explaining why she's saying it's not him.
Now, police think that the officer there thinks that, or formed the opinion, that Holland is ditching these pants. Is that...
I don't know whether they did or not. The important thing is not so much what he was doing with the pants, but here's a man holding pants that that for whatever reason that the victim says he had. Even believing him that he was just going to the garbage can to throw away the beer bottles and the liquor bottle and then going back into the house, for whatever reason, he happened to walk out with these pants in his hand. And they tied him directly to the rape.
Before the show up, had they already followed the tracks and recovered the shoes?
Yes.
Before the show up?
Well, I don't know about the shoes. They certainly
had wet shoes, see, and with the tracks.
Yes.
And I just, the reason I'm saying, how much did they know before they bring her over there?
Right. Now Miss Stanley ultimately testifies at her deposition that she is told at the show up by the officers that they found the clothes he was wearing and the shoes at the time of the show up. So if you believe that, then of course they did have them. There's no contrary evidence that they didn't find the shoes prior to this show up.
At the show up, was she? Did she see the pants?
I don't know whether the officer showed her the pants at the show up. There's no evidence that.
Is there any evidence that she said, "Oh, those are the pants. Those are those unique cartoon type pants that the rapist was wearing"?
Well. There's no evidence that I can't remember any evidence in the record saying that. What I do know is even at the rape trial years later, she testified that the, I, you know, that Well, no, she didn't testify to this at the trial. Let me correct myself. After he was exonerated at her deposition in this action, she said that I told lies at the trial when I identified him as the rapist, but what was definitely true is that the blue jeans that the rapist was wearing had these cartoon characters on them. So it was, she was asked that at her deposition, and she specifically answered that question. Going back to the show-up, you know, I think I talked about why the officers wouldn't have believed her when she said that at first, when she denied that he was the rapist. The overwhelming evidence would have been reason enough, but certainly a person in that circumstance, a woman in that circumstance, there's reason to expect that from prudent officers to expect that she would be emotional. And there was evidence, she had told them that she had been drinking that night, and she had also told them that she had used drugs the previous day. So there was every reason.
Not particularly nice behavior by an 8-month pregnant woman.
Perhaps so.
This is all ongoing, though. From the time they meet in the bar and drink and whatever, drugs and whatever, and then go out to get some more, this is all the same guy.
It's all the same guy.
Yeah, well, I assume at some point along the way she saw his pants, and maybe even when she was sober. So the pants probably...
She certainly told... There's no doubt about the fact that she told the officers, certainly before they took Mr. Holland off to jail from the scene of the arrest, she certainly had told the officers about the pant at that point. But now what happens after she denies that it's him at the show-up. We're back at the show-up. She denies that it's him. Then statements are made to her. One of those statements is, you can go home when you say it's him. It's not accurate to characterize that as you have to identify him
if I may. Is it you can go home when you identify him, or you can't go home until you identify him?
Well,
I mean, isn't there some dispute? And I suggest that phrasing could be pivotal, if you're focusing on coercion.
Well, the evidence in the record is only that you can go home when you say it's him. She said, I understood that to mean that I couldn't go home until I did. Fair or not, she didn't say they said you can't go home. She said you can go home when you do.
Well, either way, it has the potential for coercive suggestion.
Absolutely. And prudent officers in that circumstance, it was improper. Prudent officers in that circumstance should know that it's improper and maybe even tainted the identification. But the proper question is, once she did say it's him, even though the identification is tainted, what are the officers to believe? Are they simply to discard the identification completely and their knowledge of all this evidence, including the blue jeans, that they already had that connected him to the crime? Or would prudent officers in that circumstance have believed that her identification of him meant that he really was the rapist and wasn't because she was coerced? They had no way of knowing for sure whether it was coerced or whether it was the truth from her lips. But prudent officers in that circumstance, with all that evidence, would have certainly believed that it wasn't coerced. That the reason that she's saying this is because it was really him. And of course, she never countermanded that. She was interviewed by the state's attorney a year later and never said that it wasn't him. She identified him at trial. Obviously she explains that away by the assistant state's attorney telling her that she would be up on perjury charges if she didn't. But there's no evidence in this record to suggest that when the officers arrested Mr. Holland, that they did so for any reason other than the overwhelming evidence supporting that.
My inquiry was not so much to probable cause as it was this lineup and What evidence in the record exists as to what occurred at trial with regarding this identification and the exchange between the female officer and...
She was asked at trial, what did the officer say to her? And she said, well, they said, is it him? And she said, I initially said it's not him. And they asked her why you said that, and she said, because I was afraid. And then on cross examination, she was asked, well, why were you afraid? And she said, because I was afraid of him. He had hurt me. So it was actually addressed at trial. Before I stop, I'd like to talk about the Brady claim, the suppression of evidence claim. Mr. Holland argues that that the officers suppressed evidence of the statements that Ms. Stanley Ms. Stanley says were made to her at that show up. His argument is incorrect because it is well established that suppression does not occur when the criminal defendant could have discovered the evidence himself through reasonable diligence. And here, Mr. Holland's attorney failed to speak with any of the officers about the show up. That was fatal to his Brady claim, because it meant that the attorney failed to act with reasonable diligence. The attorney did speak with Ms. Stanley, and she didn't tell him about the statements the officers made to her at the show-up. But there's no evidence that she withheld that information from the attorney because of anything that either of the officers said or did to her. She simply withheld that information. By then, it was years after the incident had occurred. There was no longer any connection with the officers. There's no evidence in the record that she ever saw the officers from the moment that day ended until the incident ended until the day of.
Anything in the record to indicate that the attorney spoke to either officer?
No. The defense attorney, Mr. Tountas, did not ever acknowledged at his deposition in this action that he never spoke with those officers or either of the other two officers who were investigating the case, never spoke to them at all. And, of course, Mr. Holland would have known at the show-up because he said, I heard her say, it's not me. And he would have known that ultimately she must have said it was. And he also
he wouldn't be possessed of knowledge of that dialogue between the officers and the victim.
That's right. But he would have known that she ultimately did identify him because he was charged. And he was known he didn't do it. So he had to know that, or the first thought would have been whether she said something, the officer said something to her that made her change her mind. So the first thing that should have happened is his attorney should have interviewed those officers and said, what was said at that show-up? Could that account for why she might have identified Mr. Holland as the rapist? And he never bothered to talk with them. That's the absence of reasonable diligence in this case.
Did they ever present Gordon Bolden to her? This is just what baffles me about this. From some point, let's just say noon, all the way through the day till 6 in the morning, she's, belatedly we know, she's with Gordon Bolden.
Right.
Wearing these funny pants. And he testifies at the trial that he had consensual sex.
That's right.
He's the one.
That's right.
What just baffles me here is that nobody ever got them face to face.
Well, that's right.
Is that the defense attorney's fault, or is it because the prosecutors, you know, he listed him right off. You want Gordon Bolden.
That's right. You're right. The very first time that Bolden reenters, Bolden actually testifies before the grand jury 2 weeks after the rape. The state's attorneys get him and have him testify. He testifies, and after his testimony, the grand jury indicts Holland.
Well, did he say before the grand jury that he had consensual sex with
No.
him?
He didn't mention that until the day of trial. That never is known until the day of trial.
What did he testify to?
He just He was asked what his whereabouts on the evening, and actually, when you look at his testimony, it would have allowed the window of time that he had that the rape was committed, and yet the grand jury still indicts Holland, not him.
So what he testified?
Why was he called?
Excuse me.
Why was he called? Do we know in the record why Bolden was called?
Well, Bolden is called by the defense to exonerate Mr. Holland at trial.
Jury. No, not the grand jury.
Oh, why was he called? Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. There's no evidence in the record. The grand jury testimony is extremely short. There's no evidence in the record at all about why he was called. And, of course, any gaps in the record on a case like this where the plaintiff has to prove facts in order to prevail, the facts must be taken against him. For these reasons, we request that the judgment in this case be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKay. Ms. Pryor, as I indicated, your time had expired, but you may have an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to focus first on the timing issue with respect to what happened before the show-up. Actually, I can answer that question, Judge. The record shows that the defendant officers arrived on the scene. They saw the perpetrator running away, that he dropped a knife, and Officer Cullinan immediately went to follow after him. He encountered Mr. Holland in the alley behind Mr. Holland's residence a very short time later. So as far as what the record supports in terms of how much time he had to change his pants or his shoes, it was very little, actually. It's not, if we had to guess, it's probably less than 5 or 10 minutes, but certainly not a long period of time at all. As far as I believe counsel said that the state's attorney was never told by the victim that it was not Mr. Holland. That is not the case at all. When the state's attorney met with her, she said, once again, it's not him, and she was told that she would be charged with perjury if she did not, again, identify him at trial. So I just wanted to correct that.
Do you know anything about the grand jury testimony?
No, it was very brief, and I did cite in my brief the fact that the grand jury does, what the prosecutor does, doesn't cut off the causation with respect to the officer's misconduct. So
just to reiterate, were Bolden and Holland both convicted on this other crime and then were in prison?
Yes, I believe that's correct. Yes.
During all this time?
Well, I'm not sure. Not the whole time. No.
They apparently jointly committed this other crime.
They were convicted.
Were convicted and in prison.
That's correct, but that doesn't over.
It was after this one, I assume.
I'm sorry, Judge. I'm not clear on the timing of when it was. I think it was before, actually. I think it was a prior incident, but I'm not entirely sure on that. I don't think that crime should be relevant at all to this analysis.
It isn't relevant except that Bolden is in the picture. And this is what is baffles me.
Right. And the fact that the officers and nobody actually at any point in time showed her a picture of Mr. Bolden, and she was not shown those pants at the scene either. So there's in no way, shape, or form did she identify the particular pants that Mr. Holland had in his hand as the pants that the perpetrator was wearing. That did not happen. Why that didn't happen, that's just another question as to why the officers didn't do more to make sure they had the right man when she repeatedly said it was not him. I just wanted to end on this note. We keep hearing in the briefs and then in oral argument today, overwhelming evidence, overwhelming evidence, overwhelming evidence. Actually, there was no detail given in the briefs or an argument today by defense counsel about any evidence that supports the notion of reasonable suspicion other than the pants issue. I haven't heard one detail besides the pants issue. And again, why didn't they show her the pants? She did not identify those pants at the scene. So we would ask that the court view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. Many of these issues, malice, probable cause to a degree, are issues of fact. And there are certainly genuine issues of material fact at a minimum.
Ms. Pryor, before you retire from the podium, do you want to just cabin for me the essence of your Brady argument? What was not turned over that you feel is critical in this case?
Sure. It would be the coercive statement made to the victim, you can't go home until you identify him.
At what point in the investigation should that have occurred? Is it some
voluntary comment by the police officers once a defense attorney was in place. I'm just trying to see where the bridge is between the events as you described them and when the alleged prosecutorial misconduct would have occurred.
Well, I guess they continued to suppress the evidence. I guess that's the point. I'm not sure if I'm misunderstanding your question.
When you speak of evidence, the evidence being this dialogue about not being able to identify and you can't go home.
And the false statements about the shoes matching the footprints and the fact that he was throwing away clothes that matched her description, those statements as well. The misstatements of the facts that this is the guy.
On the shoes, maybe I misheard Mr. Enrique. There's a suggestion that whatever shoes were there, those wet shoes, did match.
No, that's not the case. And they actually didn't find those shoes until later. At the show up, all they knew was that a black man left the scene. And all they were told by her before they brought him for the show up was that a tall black man wearing a tan coat was the rapist. That's all they knew when they brought him for the show up. So those statements are you wouldn't expect them to ever reveal them because they were coercive and the defendant admits improper. So it's not surprising that they were never revealed.
If the comments had been, you're just not sure, aren't you? Would that be the same kind of comment that should have been turned over to the defense? In other words, if you have a show-up such as this one was, and there's, let's say, a repeated half-dozen inquiries about... How can you not see this? This crossed the line... Why?
I think the answer to that question, Your Honor, would be the totality of circumstances. And this crossed the line because of the circumstances as a whole. Because she has spent so much time with the rapist, because she was in a position to be able to identify him, it wasn't a fleeting moment. So, in the context of your question, you're just not sure, are you? If you're dealing with a victim who's afraid or physically afraid of the guy you're putting in front of her who only saw his face for maybe 30 seconds or something, I could see that being acceptable. But, you know, you've got a victim who's clearly not afraid of the person they're showing her who is adamantly saying it's not him. And so, you know, in that context, that's what sets this case apart from what you just described.
Alice connected with this push to identify Holland.
That is our contention.
And why would that be?
Why would the police behave that way? I guess a rush to judgment. I don't want to. I guess it's anybody's guess. I can imagine.
Because of the prior conviction, do you think?
I think that's possible. I think it could just be a rush to judgment. You know, it's late at night in a bad neighborhood, and I respect our officers, but, you know, let's just get this over with and get the first person we can, you know. And I can't think of any other explanation since they were offered up the actual perpetrator and didn't ever show him to her. So it is a bizarre case. It really is.
When is he offered up, as you say?
By Mr. Holland to the officers, not to the victim. And that's what's so particularly disturbing is the victim never sees a picture of him. There's no effort made to talk to him or confirm that he's the registered owner of the car, which he was. The fact that the victim never sees him and only sees him by accident the day of trial or in trial prep is just mind-boggling, really. So the identification really was tainted, and the motivation behind it, I can't tell you, but certainly under the law, it's circumstantial evidence of malice.
I know you mentioned that earlier conviction shouldn't play out, and here we have apparently or allegedly Holland offering up Bolden. Do we have anything similar to that scenario in the prior?
Not that I'm aware of, no. No, in the Wembley case, no, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement.